This is Indie Colorcast, powered by Radio Kismet.
This is Andrew Benioff with the Independent Lodging Congress for the Indie Colorcast project. Today, I'm happy to welcome Tony Ewing. Tony is a principal at Shift Capital, a social impact real estate firm that deploys development strategies in underserved neighborhoods by aligning capital and long-term community success. Welcome, Tony. Thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate it, man.
Thanks for having me. Great to see you, Andrew.
Good to see you as well. So let's start. I always like to start with people's background so that we can understand a little bit of who you are. I know that you are a Cornellian, as am I, and studied mechanical engineering there undergrad. That's pretty neat. And then you went and got an MBA at Wharton at UPenn. So why did you start in what was attractive about engineering, mechanical engineering?
So interestingly, and thanks for having me. Thanks for doing this, Andrew. There was not a whole lot of forethought that went into it, truth be told. Yeah, okay. 17 years old in high school, one of my physics teachers pulls me aside and says, hey, you're pretty good at science. You're pretty good at math. You should think about engineering. I said, okay, why not? Let's give it a shot. As I looked into it a little further, I realized that it was a fairly robust degree that could be applied in many different ways. You know, there was something about specifically the mechanics of physics and engineering that appealed to me, you know, seeing things go, hard assets, which plays into real estate later. That kind of thing really appealed to me. I grew up in Western New York, in Rochester, New York, Kodak country back in the day, as you may recall.
Cold country, right? Very cold.
indeed, cold. And, you know, after 3 internships at Kodak in one of their service engineering groups supporting their paper manufacturing division, I realized that is not what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I appreciate everything that those guys do and that, you know, the engineering team at that time did to support the organization. That's not how I saw me spending my days, and I ended up finishing the degree, but ended up pivoting more toward software consulting and sales of services after college.
And is that why you decided to eventually get a business degree?
Yeah, well, you know, I rode the technology bubble edge, surfed that edge from 96 to about 01, when it came to a crashing halt in terms of my technology ventures, primarily out of New York. And, you know, realized that I really did not know what I wanted to do when I grew up. So I had some friends that had gone back to business school. They had advised me that, hey, you know, it's a great place to sort of not just augment your current skills, but do some introspection and figure out what trajectory you want to pursue next in life. And ultimately, that's what drove me back to pursuing the degree. I'm very fortunate, I think, that I had the opportunity to stay in the Northeast and go to Wharton. Yeah, and it was there, quite frankly, not really knowing what I wanted to pursue. I looked at marketing, looked at finance. Of course, if you go to Wharton, you have to look at investment banking, looked at private equity, discovered real estate, had dabbled a little bit in a couple of very small transactions earlier in life, but really discovered real estate as an asset class and as an industry while I was at Wharton. And they've got a very robust, not just program of study and major itself, but a very robust student club. There is an endowed research center on campus, the Zell Lurie Research Center, I know you're familiar with, exposes that student body to the industry at large in a very hands-on experiential way. And it was very eye-opening. And once I had an opportunity to kind of, you know, touch real estate, no pun intended, it was a wrap. That was the way I wanted to go.
That's awesome. So after you earned your MBA, you actually ended up spending the next 15 years at Liberty Property Trust, which is actually a company that is no longer in existence because it was purchased by Prologis a few years ago, or a year ago, something like that. But that Liberty Re was, I believe, you tell me if I'm wrong, but mostly focused at one point on office and then sort of morphed into office and industrial and then changed mostly towards industrial real estate. Not exactly what we're focused on here at the Independent Lodging Congress. But nonetheless, I think that background sort of shaped you as a real estate investor and developer. Tell us about your career progression and what you learned at Liberty, why that experience was important to you.
Indeed, indeed. By the way, by the end of my tenure there, I had the opportunity to touch three lodging projects.
Oh, wow.
Three actual hotel projects through Liberty, and I'll articulate that as we proceed. But the punchline is I discovered Philadelphia when I got here as well, in addition to discovering real estate. And this is the place that my family and I decided to plant our roots for the foreseeable future. And therefore, I pursued opportunities here in Philly proper. Liberty has its roots. The patriarch of Liberty Property Trust is a gentleman named Willard Rouse, or Bill Rouse, who was responsible for developing the first skyscrapers that broke the plane of William Penn's hat, as it were, in Philly. So, you know, he's a legend of sorts here and quite a philanthropist. So City Hall, which is Main and Main in Philadelphia, the corner of Main Street and Broad Street, sorry, Market Street and Broad Street, historically, so that structure at the very top of it is a statue of William Penn. William Penn is in that statue wearing a hat. And so the horizontal plane of that vertical height had been an unwritten threshold over which buildings would not exceed, the height of which they would not exceed, such that the top of that statue, i.e. Billy Penn's hat, was the tallest point in the city. Again, this was not rule, this was not law, this was not code, it was just behavior. And along comes Bill Rouse with an idea to not just exceed, but, you know, I don't know the heights, but let's say more than double the height of that. And it met with a great deal of resistance, formal and informal, legal and illegal. But ultimately, the persistence pursued and Liberty One, Liberty Place, Building One was the first to do that. And then, you know, since then, most new buildings going in Center City will exceed that height. So That's sort of the long-winded explanation of what that means. Anyway, so fast forward, Liberty Property Trust is the succeeding organization in the trail of Bill Rouse's efforts, which is a publicly traded firm whose headquarters moved out to Malvern, Pennsylvania, and then Wayne, Pennsylvania, over the years. Ended up having about 22 offices nationally, one over in the UK, with an enterprise value upwards of $10 billion in its heyday. When I joined, it was about 50-50, office to industrial. We here in Philly know it mostly as an office company. But outside of Philly, it has been primarily an industrial firm in terms of its growth over the years. And again, it was about 50-50 when I joined in 2004. Over the years, as you indicated, for a number of reasons, including the Great Recession, the writing on the wall was that the suburban office campus concentration, which is where we were, was declining in value, that the future rents didn't look good, valuations didn't look good. So we got out fairly early and made a fairly intentional pivot toward industrial, becoming industrial heavy. So it went from 50-50 to about 80-20 industrial to office 5 years later. And at the end of the day, they went a step further and said, that's it, we're out of office, period. And so once that took place, and at the time I was here in Philadelphia really working on our office and lab and mixed use portfolios, that was no longer going to be the future of the company, and it was time for me to make a move. But over that 15-year period, I had a chance to lease, buy, build, own, and operate small single-story flex buildings, large industrial distribution centers, large multi-tenant warehouses, skyscrapers, retail storefronts, buildings doing cell and gene therapy, LEED platinum certified office buildings occupied by Fortune 100 companies. It really offered me a plethora of opportunity to see and learn the full life cycle of real estate development, of operating a portfolio, of managing people, managing tenants, really being the hub of all the professionals around me, including contractors, architects, engineers, lawyers, tenants, brokers, county officials, etc., financiers, lenders. And it was, you know, very, very much set the tone. It was a great ground for learning the business over those 15 years. As you indicated, at the end of the day, that pure play industrial firm was acquired by Prologis, the largest global publicly traded REIT out there.
Yeah, interesting. So amazing background. And then more recently, when the company was sold, you decided to make a change, decide on a bit of a career change, still in real estate, but a quite a different company. And you went over to Shift Capital, which is a regional developer here in Philadelphia. But I think a quite an interesting one. It's not, we have a lot of developers here, as there are in many cities around the country. But Shift has a little bit of a different strategy and ethos, I would say. Talk to us a little bit about Shift. For those people who don't know, give us you know, what Shift is all about and what you guys are trying to do.
So when I made that move, I very explicitly wanted to go to a smaller, more entrepreneurial outfit, right? I had done kind of a big corporate gig. It was, again, fantastic ground to learn. Now I was searching for the right platform to bring those skill sets to bear in perhaps a more robust fashion. In addition to that, the idea was to also see where I could align my other interests in terms of community and economic development. Enter Shift Capital, it is a fund-based real estate development and investment firm. It is vertically integrated such that similarly, it buy, builds, owns, and operates real estate with a very explicit thesis of going into historically underinvested neighborhoods and serving a constituency of historically underserved people. So that manifests itself today in about a 2 million square foot portfolio concentrated in North Philadelphia, North Kensington to be specifically, along the Market Frankford line. It's a mix across asset classes of old commercial manufacturing and industrial buildings, commercial storefronts and mixed-use buildings. We have a portfolio of scattered site single-family housing, and we've got a couple of significant ground-up developments underway as well. But again, it is very much focused on leveraging real estate investment and leveraging capitalism to some degree to take a neighborhood-wide approach and apply that toward a sustainable impact on a neighborhood, i.e. its constituents have an opportunity to participate in the investment that is happening in the neighborhoods.
Amazing. Now, you mentioned, just so I'm clear on this, you said it's a fund structure. Do you have a fund of committed capital that you use to acquire these properties?
That is correct. It was closed just under $50 million some years back. It has been deployed in terms of acquisitions. You know, obviously there's operations as well of the organization, but it's, you know, and then we go on to fund, usually on an asset-based or project-based level, and other capital sources for the development or redevelopment projects themselves.
So I know that gentrification is sort of a word that engenders lots of different feelings from people. Is that something that you guys are focused on so that the areas that you're developing don't see that kind of gentrification, or is it not something that you pay too much attention to? How do you guys look at gentrification?
Can't not pay attention to it and do what we do. So that's number one. Absolutely pay attention to it. And it, the word gentrification, as you intimated there, is a loaded word. And quite frankly, we don't use it as a negative word. The negative word is displacement. That is what we are attempting to fight, is displacement. You know, gentrification, and I'll even just stop using the expression. We go in to invest in underinvested neighborhoods. And again, want those who are, you know, populations that currently live there have an opportunity to participate. That is, to not get displaced because of, you know, these exogenous factors that are coming in without their control. So how do we do that? Well, you know, number one, there's, you know, clearly affordability is probably the closest aligned word to it. You know, if you come in and put a whole, you know, block of new product out there and price the existing population out of that product, then you end up with the displacement that is, you know, so harmful to these neighborhoods and harmful to individuals. So finding a way creatively, and it's not easy, generally, it's certainly not easy here in Philadelphia, to find methodologies to deliver affordable, so to say workforce, you know, housing, and or affordable commercial space. So that said, taking a step back, the specific strategy that SHIFT has taken is to, you know, try to find a catalytic project in a neighborhood. For example, in Kensington, we went in and bought a number of old manufacturing buildings, two of which are located on I Street in the Harrogate section of Philadelphia, North I Street, about two blocks away, about 100,000 feet, and the other one's about 120,000 feet. And the first idea is, how do we turn those vacant buildings into job creators? You know, it was an entire learning process along the way, but one of the buildings ended up turning into 60 different suites, ranging between 500 and 2,500 square feet, that houses entrepreneurs and woodworkers and metal workers and a kombucha place and a photography studio and a lawyer and a hair salon and an eclectic small business that's looking for a quality home, a quality suite to operate. You know, we've got it. That was one, and that's catalytic because that literally is housing businesses that are of and serve those local constituents. And the other building started going down that path, but the demand curve actually shifted toward social services. So we've got probably 35, 40,000 square feet of nonprofits in that other building that, again, serve the local population so that it is accretive to it. So A, we're creating jobs. B, we're creating, you know, patronage as well for those wares that people are making and the like. Then the idea is, okay, once there's some sort of job creators or some catalyst there, how do we invest around it for this whole neighborhood approach? So number one, safe and affordable housing. Therein lies the scattered site portfolio. Therein lies a redevelopment of a local furniture distribution warehouse into 116 units that we should be delivering next month that has a very specific AMI, average median income targets, without subsidies, by the way, to serve that population. So safe and affordable housing. And then we focus on the Kensington corridor itself for services, for food, for amenities, and the like, to create, again, a neighborhood where folks can gather. obviously the pandemic has thrown a wrench in that. The opioid epidemic in Kensington has put a wrench, you know, in that as well. These are other exogenous factors that we have to navigate. This stuff is just not easy. But, you know, that's kind of how holistically how the plan comes together.
Really, really interesting. It sounds like each of these projects is, there's a lot of moving parts that you're taking into consideration. I mean, real estate development itself is difficult just in and of itself with all the different little things you need to do to have a successful development. Then you add in this neighborhood revitalization, how you're thinking about things. It's challenging. It's interesting. Talk about how you engage with communities. Is it different for every neighborhood, or do you guys have sort of an overall strategy that's somewhat similar when you hit a new neighborhood and you're like, okay, now we really want to try to figure this out? How do you engage?
What's universal is early and often is critical. It should be critical for anybody. We find it critical for us to engage, again, very early and keep it going. Because, you know, one part of it is literally just establishing a respectful, mutually respectful relationship with community leadership so that there is even, you know, a practical and a perceived inclusion to being part of the process. That should be low-hanging fruit to most people, but it's not for some reason, right? People just look right by. So that's number one. Part two of your question was, is it the same? Is it different? Certainly it's different. Every community has its own unique challenges, goals, missions, priorities. I think the common factors really include asking questions first before walking in the door with a quote unquote solution to a problem that we have conceived or we have perceived to exist. And we have learned that there are gaps between our perceptions of what needs to be solved and what the reality is, you know, our perceptions of what we think the demand is versus reality. So asking questions early, and by the way, listening also, you know, like listening and acting and reacting. And sometimes it's uncomfortable. Sometimes it doesn't make sense, perhaps, for a project. Well, you got to figure out, you know, is there a way to close that gap? Is there some other creative way to fill a need that is being sought after? Some communities are more organized than others. You know, Philly has its system of registered community organizations that one can look up and understand which bodies are influential in which neighborhoods. What's important on North Broad Street, for example, where we have two projects at Broad Germantown and Erie, actually three projects, including an existing building that we own, where we are very actively negotiating a community benefits agreement, a formal document that will specify our obligations as we redevelop in that neighborhood, our obligations to follow certain procedures, to prioritize certain hiring locally, to hit certain metrics in terms of community involvement, minority women, and other disadvantaged business enterprise contract awards, and the like. You know, it can be somewhat informal early on. With the larger projects, it typically graduates into something much more formal and memorialized on paper, or somewhere in between.
And I think you're right. A lot of people skip that step. A lot of developers skip that step and are not as engaged with the community as they could be, which often manifests itself with problems later in the project. So kudos to you guys for what you're doing. So in finishing up here, I sort of want to understand, what's been the most rewarding aspect of working at Shift? What have you enjoyed the most?
I think the most rewarding is yet to come. So I'll throw that out there. It's been 18 months, and half of that has been in this new normal. But so it's been tough sledding. But what is rewarding in that context is that there is now a new light shined on many of the topics and issues that Shift has been attacking, prior to the pandemic and, I'll say national social unrest and this new awakening of consciousness of sorts that appears to be brewing. You know, prior to all of that, Shift had this mission, and it's been, as I mentioned, it's been tough sledding. Now there's more eyeballs on these disparities. There's now a new nomenclature that folks are using, such as equity and inclusion and diversity. New words that are now more readily being utilized by the population at large. So it's heartening to see that there's a lot of interest, I think, in what it is that organizations like Shift are trying to do. We're getting calls, quite frankly, from other cities and other organizations that are trying to figure out a way to integrate impact into what they do, whether it's real estate development, whether it's investments, whether it's the metrics behind impact. One of the pieces to the Shift special sauce is actually taking account and accumulating metrics of job creation, crime reduction, harm reduction, household health, taking pulse of the wraparound services and the like, and kind of trying to really provide proof, measurable statistics that articulate benefit of quote unquote impact investing. And there's a whole world of impact investing out there that has been open, my eyes have been open to it, that I had never really understood before. So again, just personally, being exposed to these new areas of investment, these new areas of industry, and seeing that other folks, in their various ways are attempting to solve some of the same problems.
It's amazing. Find it not only fascinating, but fantastic what you guys are doing and how you're, leading the way for others to follow. I really hope that more of this is happening. But for us here in Philadelphia, it's wonderful to have you here, and all of your efforts don't go unnoticed. So, thank you very much. And really appreciate you being with me today, Tony. It was a great conversation. I hope that the rest of the year finishes out well for you and, sort of looking towards the future, and we'll have some rays of sunshine happening here soon.
Same to you, Andrew. Thanks so much.
This is Indie Colorcast, powered by Radio Kismet. And I'm Andrew Benioff, founder and chairman of the Independent Lodging Congress. Indie Colorcast is where we explore independent hospitality, entrepreneurship, and society at large, through conversations with leaders in our community of hoteliers, designers, and others to encourage idea generation and new ways of conducting meaningful business. Indie Colorcast.